It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we'll share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, Chewing the Fat with Rex and Paul, interviews with some of your favorite musical artists on Arkansas Sound, content from the Butler Center's collections, information about what's happening in the library system, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear by contacting us at radiocals@cals.org. This program is presented by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies and the Cals Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information about Radio Cals, including links to resources mentioned in our segments, please visit the Butler Center's blog at butlercenter.org.
Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a featured production of Radio Cals. Here on Primary Sources, we focus on people who are making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know more about. Check out cals.org/podcasts for a free podcast of Primary Sources interviews.
Welcome to another episode of Primary Sources, a service of Central Arkansas Library System. I am Matt DeCampbell. Our guest this time is Rachel Silva Patton, the Executive Director of Preserve Arkansas. Thanks for being here, Rachel.
Thank you.
To start off, we need, I think, to do a little Preservation 101 because a lot of people, first of all, don't know that we have statewide preservation efforts. Second, they don't know that there is both a state funded one and a nonprofit one that works with the state one, and that you've worked for both.
Right.
So unpack that a little bit for us. Tell us about the organizations and in general how they work.
Okay. Well, you're right that there's never enough education and outreach done to get the message across to everyone. So we try to tell everybody that will listen about the State Historic Preservation Office and about Preserve Arkansas. And the difference between the two is the Arkansas Historic Preservation Program is an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage, obviously state-funded, and they have a pretty large staff of about 35 to 40 people who work on everything from the National Register of Historic Places for Arkansas, tax credits for historic rehabilitation, grants to nonprofits and to municipal governments, technical assistance, and more.
How long did you work there?
I worked at AHPP for about 8.5 years.
Okay. And then last year you transitioned to?
To Executive Director of Preserve Arkansas, formerly known as the Historic Preservation Alliance of Arkansas. And still officially that's what it is.
But Preserve Arkansas is an easier name to remember.
It rolls off, a little easier. So Preserve Arkansas is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we do advocacy, education, and technical assistance for preservationists all over the state and historic property owners. So the main difference between the state office and us is that we can advocate and say a lot more openly things about particular preservation projects than they are allowed to do.
Ah.
So
what did you start to discover as you became part of the AHPP and then started going around the state and seeing buildings and encountering people?
Oh, well, there are so many stories I could tell from my time at AHPP, but, you know, my job was preservation outreach coordinator. So I led tours, regular monthly tours of properties in Central Arkansas, and then a regular monthly tour of a district or larger site somewhere all over the state. So there was a lot of travel, and then also if any type of club or, you know, Rotary Club, Lions Club, whoever, City of Warren, whoever called and wanted a program, then that was also my job to go and do all the adult programs. So
while you're leading tours, was there ever a time that you discovered something new on a historic property while showing people around it? You know what I mean?
There were definitely times that I uncovered facts or details about properties
yeah.
that people who had lived there their entire lives didn't know.
Oh.
It wouldn't necessarily be something I would see, you know, as we were doing the tour, but something that I would have found and I would tell them during the program that they would not have known.
What kind of things?
Oh, I mean, you'd be amazed. Every walking tour, I couldn't, like, point out one particular thing, but every walking tour I think I've ever done, I mean, these are two-hour walking tours. We cover an entire downtown.
Sure. So what kind of things do, say, your typical homeowner or your typical longtime resident of an area, what kinds of things do they generally not know about where they live?
A lot of times the very early history, and then there are a lot of stories that are told about people and places that kind of turn into, you know, they're just passed down, and some mm-hmm. of those aren't true. And people go on believing that, and they don't want to hear any different. And so that's kind of the thing that, you know, dispelling some of these myths about places was also part of it. A lot of interesting characters around the state, for sure.
Well, what are one or two myths that you had to dispel that kind of might have been met with, oh, like they really wanted it to be real, you know what I mean? But you had to say, sorry, that's not historically accurate.
Oh, a lot. I can't think of anything in particular, but that happened all the time.
Are we talking about, like, legends about specific properties, like so-and-so died in this house and their ghost haunted it for 50 years, or there was a gunfight in the main street of this community so many years ago?
Here's one. Everybody thinks that DeSoto was in their town. Mm. They think that there might be, like, gold coins in the base of this column that holds up the bank building. You know, just treasure stories. Some, not as many ghost stories, probably, but stories of buried treasure or finding, you know, a piece of DeSoto's armor or his helmet or something like that.
So you never found any treasure?
No.
Yet?
Not yet.
Let's make that qualifier.
Not yet.
There's still a lot of time.
No.
What kind of things do you take to, say, civic groups or others to get them interested and or excited about the history in their communities?
Well, I mean, that's it. If you talk about their community, they're interested.
Okay.
So it would be, the key to those presentations would be to do a little research and tell them maybe something they didn't know about their own town. And then the other key I found is really dramatic before and after pictures, because people have a hard time visualizing mm-hmm. historic preservation projects whenever they're looking at a dilapidated building. They automatically think, well, this is just too far gone. It needs to be torn down. And then you see a before and after picture of something that looks like it was about to blow over the next storm, you know, that came through, that's right. been saved mm-hmm. and looks fantastic. And that kind of would give them hope, like, okay, this can be done, you know, in a town similar to ours, because it's being done all over the state.
Yeah.
So that's probably the key things.
Since we're sitting here in Little Rock, what are a couple of historic things about Little Rock a lot of people probably aren't familiar with?
Ooh. I think two of my favorite stories as of late about historic properties. One is the Villa Marie. That one has a very interesting history that a lot of people may not know. They just know that as the Designing Women House.
Right.
Then what, and it was the Designing Women House.
Yes, it was. But what is the history they don't know?
The history that many people don't know about Villa Marie is about the original owners of the home, Angelo Marie and his wife, Jenny. And he operated a saloon in Little Rock and was kind of a scoundrel.
What made him a scoundrel?
Well, he had a really bad temper, and he had gotten in trouble for being involved in the saloon business and in prostitution business and other things of that nature over in Memphis, where he was from. And so then he just kind of skedaddled on over to Little Rock whenever he was in too much trouble to start over fresh.
But did he start a lot? I mean, he obviously started a saloon. Was there a brothel component to his saloon?
I don't know that there was in Little Rock, but Okay, so he moved here. Mm-hmm. Then his wife was also, you know, not a very reputable character whenever she came to Little Rock, because she had run off. She was also from Memphis, Jenny, and she had fallen in love with her uncle. Mm. He was ill, injured from a duel, I think, and fell ill too.
Happen.
And so they took care of him mm-hmm. in her house. And then she falls in love with her uncle. They run away to Fort Smith so that they can be together. And then she met Angelo Marie. She leaves the first husband but never gets divorced. And she marries Angelo Marie.
Even though the first marriage may not have been legal.
Right.
Yeah.
But that was what she came back with yeah. in her own defense. She was being charged with either incest or, you know, or bigamy. So she said, well, I was never legally married, and it wasn't, you know, seen as a valid marriage in the eyes of the Catholic Church, so it's fine. So that's how she got out of it. But everybody in Little Rock knew about it. It was all written in the newspaper for everyone to read. So she and Angelo are quite the pair here, living here in Little Rock. They build the Villa Marie in 1881 and live there on Scott Street. Angelo Marie fathered at least one child with another woman. There's, you know, evidence to show that he may have had more. But he named this child Angelo Marie Jr. So it was
wow.
no secret. I mean, way to go.
Yeah, not subtle.
No. So, you know, she was kind of the talk of the town, and he was too. And even though she was seen as maybe not having the best character, he would defend her, you know, and he was known to like have slapped people and pulled their ears in the Capitol Hotel for talking bad about Jenny Marie. And he cut his toe on a fishing trip and refused to see a doctor and then died of blood poisoning.
Wow.
And then she remarried, and then they thought that she was poisoned by her third husband. She would always drink wine from this decanter in the hallway every night, and they found her dead in the floor, you know, with the open decanter that she had just taken the swig of wine.
And this was all, so she continued to operate the Villa Marie after?
She lived there for a little okay. bit longer, and then she moved to another house with her next husband.
That yeah. is, yeah. See, that's like...
Isn't that juicy?
That is juicy. Those are the stories we want. That's what we
yeah,
do here at Cal's.
Yeah,
we make history fun, as does, of course, Preserve Arkansas.
Yes.
What do you have another one for Little Rock? Because I think you mentioned you had...
The next one is about First Presbyterian Church in Little Rock at the corner of, what is that, 8th and Scott?
Scott, yep. I believe so.
Yep. So First Pres, an interesting story there, is that there was a young girl named Floella McDonald who was murdered, and her body was hidden up in the belfry, in the bell tower at First Presbyterian Church. And this was in April of 1927. And, you know, it's gruesome, but because of this persistent stench, mm-hmm. the man who cleaned the church, he found her body up in the belfry eventually.
Do they know how long it was before she was found? Or
I
know,
don't know.
Forensics probably weren't.
Maybe a week or two. So they found her body, and so immediately he was the prime suspect. He was black, and then his son became the prime suspect soon after that. He had a teenage son, and another young white child had then accused the son of harassing her. And so then he and his son were both in hot water over this.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up taking them to the jail in Texarkana to keep them safe. And that was a good idea because there was a huge mob that descended on Little Rock City Hall and demanded to know where they were, and they went to the jail and all over and couldn't find them. So racial tensions were running very high mm-hmm. at that point in time, and they were gone in Texarkana, so there was nobody to really take it out on immediately. And then a couple weeks later in May of 27, a separate, completely unrelated incident takes place on the western edge of the city. A man named John Carter supposedly harasses a white woman and her daughter in their carriage. Whenever this happens, you know, he ran off. He knew that something, whenever they made a stink, he knew something bad was going to happen. So he ran off and hid. Mm-hmm. Well, there are posses of men looking for him after this happens, and they found him. And he was lynched. He was shot. His body was shot multiple times. And then he was dragged throughout the city streets for a long time. And then they brought his body to the corner of 9th and Broadway in the heart of the Black Business District. Mm-hmm.
That's
in
where
Little
Mosaic
Rock.
Templars is now.
Right. And they burned his body. They ransacked a couple churches and businesses and were pulling out pews and other wooden furniture to use as fuel for this fire. And they burned his body right there in the middle of the street. And thousands of people rioted for hours before anything was done by law enforcement.
So the Carter incident was, or at least the environment for that, was either created or inflamed by what had happened at First Pres.
Right.
Whether or not it was a legitimate concern or not. That
right.
When you're talking hysteria, that usually doesn't factor in as much as it should.
Right. So, yeah, the story at First Pres leads to the last lynching in Little Rock in 1927.
Now, Hot Springs does seem like a town that has done a very good job of embracing its history for purposes of promotion and tourism.
And, mm-hmm.
and is that a model that you think other cities can hold on to? Obviously, they don't have Al Capone living there and having bullet holes in the ceiling where he hung out and all these famous singers come
right,
through town. But
right.
is there a lot of untapped potential for that in Arkansas?
There is. I was just reading an article yesterday about the potential of these small towns. And in my opinion, I think the article was right. And in my opinion, you don't have to have the bullet hole or, you know, the place where so-and-so sat or any of that to be successful and to have a great thriving town with heritage tourism potential. And there are all these towns up and down the Delta that are small. They've experienced population loss and job, you know, the jobs have gone away from that particular town. So they need some kind of infusion, you know, into their economy to mm-hmm. help them. And this article was citing examples of small towns, some even as small as population 600, that were now thriving tourist spots because of it all starts with one really cool business or one, you know, one unique idea that somebody finds interesting. And then somebody from Little Rock will go drive out there and check it out, or somebody from Memphis or wherever will go drive to this town just to see that one cool place. It doesn't have to be a restaurant. It could be just some cool store or any unique idea that they could come up with. And these towns that they were citing all over the United States, there was this huge resurgence in popularity of these places and mm-hmm. people leaving the big city to go live in a place where it was a little slower pace lifestyle. And they liked that. And I think that a lot of people are paying close attention to Pine Bluff right now with them just passing their sales tax mm-hmm. increase, which I think is fantastic and really excited to see what's going to happen in Pine Bluff. But I think in my mind, the Hotel Pines is something, you know, it's a huge project.
Yeah.
But it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it will happen this time. And that is something that people from all around are going to go check out whenever it gets done. And it's going to be a catalyst for development in Pine Bluff. So that's an example.
Yeah. And yeah. many others like that. When you're looking at it from a preservation angle, you see, in some areas, you see gentrification, like we've mm-hmm. been seeing in some parts of older Little Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have more of a restoration feel, like you're seeing in downtown Batesville, for example.
Right.
Is there a, from a preservation standpoint, is there a preference between those two? Or is it anything we can do to breathe life back into these main streets or these neighborhoods or these communities?
Gentrification is an unfortunate consequence of downtown revitalization a lot of times. I don't think it's good. I mean, I don't think you'd hear many preservationists or planners say that they like gentrification necessarily. It's just something that happens a lot of times, and we need to do a better job of making that not happen, mm-hmm. or at least carving out a part of that area for affordable housing so that it doesn't, you know, completely price people out of the market that have lived there for decades.
Mm-hmm.
That's not right. So I don't know. I mean, it's a tough problem to handle.
Well, and I would think that if people had a better feel for some of the history of the properties that you're talking about, they might see more potential for a restoration than just, you know, we're going to take down this old building and put up condos here or something like that.
Right. Well, you know, and infill and new development is also part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would never advocate for someone to demolish a building and construct new. If there's already a vacant lot, then yes, infill is part of that. You know, you need that density, and you need, if some of that new infill can be for affordable housing, great.
I saw in an interview you gave the whole concept that a lot of people have of preservation is we're going to take every old building we can find, we're going to fix it up and make it a museum.
Mm-hmm.
But just as important, if not more important, is taking those buildings and, yes, revitalizing them, but doing so with businesses or with, if they're old homes, residable homes.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't advocate for these buildings to become museums. And there are still a lot of people who call and talk to me and want information on tax credits or grants or National Register. And they really think it'd be a great idea if we could just turn this house into a museum. And the fact is that house museums are very, very difficult to sustain because they're not generating any income to pay for themselves. So it's not a very smart use. Mm-hmm. A lot of times,
mm-hmm.
there is a place for some house museums. Just every old house can't be a museum.
Right.
And it shouldn't be.
Right.
It should be, you know, a single family home, or sometimes historic buildings can be sensitively turned into apartments and be multi-unit buildings. And then if not that, we want commercial or office or something. We want them to be used is the main thing. And used, you know, something that's a modern use. It doesn't have to look, you know, like it's 1880 on the interior.
Right.
You don't have to have the settees and the, you know, it's, you can have comfortable furniture and modern decorations and all of that.
That's probably a concern for families who might be thinking about moving into a historic property that, you know, what kind of restrictions are there and aren't there on people that live in historic properties?
Well, this is interesting too. Most people don't understand that whenever a property is listed in the National Register of Historic Places, that's an honorary designation only. That doesn't give you protections if somebody buys your property, if you sell your property and you want to, you know, the buyer wants to demolish, then there's nothing that can be done unless there's been a conservation easement donated on that property. And the easement protects usually the exterior envelope of the property in perpetuity. It runs in perpetuity with the deed. So in that case, if you sold it, the buyer couldn't do anything. But if not, they could.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's in a local ordinance district boundary, the local ordinance district prohibits demolition. But in any other circumstance, it's not protected. So there's not any restrictions.
Mm-hmm. But if I lived in one of these houses,
mm-hmm.
what kind of restrictions are on me as far as, you know, upkeep of the house or renovations that I can or can't do?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what some people might think about when they think about moving into a historic home is, well, do
right.
I have to leave everything? I mean, I know, like you said, you can move in your comfy furniture and everything, but
yeah.
as far as the house itself, you know, what kind of guidelines are there or are there regulations on those things?
Unless you are moving into a house that has an easement,
mm-hmm.
or unless you're in a local ordinance district boundary,
then you can do whatever you
want. You could, yep, do whatever you wanted. Of course, we would try to convince you not to do things like replace all your windows. We'd try to tell you that it's better to repair them and put on storm windows than replace them with vinyl windows that are going to break in about 10 years and can't be fixed. You have to replace the whole unit instead of repairing one piece.
So it's history is energy efficient sometimes?
It is. I mean, you think about whenever buildings are demolished, how much energy does that take and money does it take to demolish a building? I mean, it can be quite hard to tear things down sometimes.
Yeah.
Because they're built really well. They were built with craftsmanship and, you know, techniques that aren't used today. So they were built to last for 100 plus years. So it's hard to tear them down. All of that material goes into the landfill, unless you have some salvage company, which not many people do. And then you have to spend the money and energy and use the other new materials for new construction.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not very energy efficient to demolish and build new. And there are steps you can take. People, you know, people always harp on the old windows. I talked about that already. The energy efficiency and complain about, you know, air infiltration. Well, you lose most of your heat and air in an old building through the ceiling and the floor. So that's fixed with insulation. You don't lose most of it through your windows.
But of course, if you wanted to do things to a historic house you bought, like put in central heat and air,
that
kind of stuff is, is not an issue.
No, that's not an issue. We want you to have central heat and air.
Yes. Yes, you do, especially as we get into the summer. So as we start to wind down, it's your opportunity to plug away. You know, how do people get involved with Preserve Arkansas?
Okay.
How do they get more information? You know, what do they do if this is interested to them, if they want to go hear even more of the story of the Villa Marie? what do they do?
Well, Preserve Arkansas is a membership-based, you know, nonprofit organization. So we would love to have people join and become members of Preserve Arkansas. And then you'd be able to get updates and hear about what types of events that we have coming up. And we'd love for you to join us for an event, even if you're not a member, to learn more about what our organization does. Our most well-known event during the year is the Arkansas Preservation Awards, which happens in January each year and recognizes outstanding preservationists and preservation projects from all over the state. And it's a nice, fancy dinner. You can.
I got to host it once.
Yeah, it's fun.
And present an award to my neighbor, which was odd but hilarious.
Cool. But it's, you know, it's a fun event, and you get to meet and greet with a lot of preservationists and other interested people, and it's fun. So you could come to that in the winter. Coming up, we have a wood window workshop that we're going to host. We're bringing in a well-known preservationist named Bob Yap from Hannibal, Missouri, and he's going to come to Hot Springs to the John Lee Webb House and show people hands-on how to remove a historic wood window, how to repair every single aspect of the window frame, the glass, everything, rehanging the weights, all of it, and then reinstall the window unit. So from beginning to end in one day, it'll be an intensive hands-on workshop.
So the best place to find all this information is?
On our website, which is preservearkansas.org.
And social media?
Social media, we're on Facebook and Twitter.
What's your Twitter handle, do you know?
Preserve AR.
Okay. And I assume Instagram.
Yes, and Instagram too.
Because, I mean, pictures.
Yes.
History, pictures.
Yes.
All of it. It's great.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else you want to plug?
Oh, I'll plug the Ramble too while I'm here. Preserve Arkansas also does an annual fall bus trip, which we call the Ramble. And it goes to a different area of Arkansas each year. And this year it'll be November the 4th. And the bus is going to leave from Little Rock and go to the Arkansas Grand Prairie, which if you don't know where the Arkansas Grand Prairie is, it's mostly Arkansas County, but it's rice country. So the Rice Country Ramble will be a lot of fun. And we'll learn about the history of rice in Arkansas. And we'll go through Stuttgart and DeWitt and Gillette and go down to Arkansas Post. It'll be a lot of fun.
During, I believe, Arkansas National Rice Month. or close
Ooh,
to it.
Okay.
Yeah. Tie it all together.
Yes.
That's what happens in Arkansas.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for being here, Rachel.
Sure.
This
thanks for having me.
It's been very enlightening in a couple of directions. Again, preservearkansas.org if you want more information and want to learn a lot more stories about Arkansas, or if you think you have some that need more attention that you think could be added to the state's history, check them out, and you can find Rachel and all the folks that she works with. You can find more episodes of Primary Sources at CALS.org, Central Arkansas Library System, CALS.org, along with a lot of other things, including a ton of historic resources that you can come check out in the Butler Center, where we are sitting right now and throughout the system. Until next time, join us and have a great day.
You've been listening to Primary Sources on Radio CALS, a production of the Central Arkansas Library System, its Arkansas History Department, the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies, and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information, please visit cals.org and butlercenter.org. Our producer is Glenn Whaley. Production manager is Shelley Stormo. Voices by Jasmine Job and John Miller. Engineering and editing by Anna Lancaster and Shelley Stormo. Our executive producers are Leanne Blackwell-Hoskin and David Strickland.